shortage on the prison level. Very large stone tools. Many of them were about the size of the palm of my hand. And were butchering tools. But large butchering tools seemed like the ones that the government used to be terrible. So I thought was the different of the margin. I still have it in the back of my mind that it was a class two balance to go around and sort it back out. But you don't have the evidence. The Otmar people were making tools exactly in the same style as tools of me were put aside over in Siberia. In Siberia, where people were still butchering mammoths, we haven't found good mammoths in Siberia. And it seems very clear that 10,000 years ago, throughout the whole tundra region, both in Asia and in Alaska, that there were many groups around, and these groups were in constant contact with each other. But there were in a very short time, that idea was spread over the whole country, both North America and the region. But at the same time, there are enough differences in the kinds of tools in the region that simply were not the same groups. And we have probably a lot of different groups around all possibly small bands of people who do pretty good together, maybe traders in ideas, but who were quite different. How people were living in the tundra at the time, for years I couldn't understand it. Imagine if you were having to live in a climate that was colder than this, or even summers, but imagine if you had no trees around, you have nothing to get cold around. It's kind of like how in the world would you survive? The tundra where the palynologist was telling us in the 50s was that the tallest trees or the tallest bushes or something like this. I couldn't understand. So there you go, some of the biologists. Now, this is then the biologists and palynologists that said that, okay, it looked like there was possibly some. And so even though there weren't any fruit, there were large purchases, and we could have talked.
They didn't say whether they released cotton.
No, there is. But I think as long as they have cotton without the great release of the index, if I can visualize it growing up enough so that at least you can get a shaft so that you can get a spear. This is out of cotton, but at least it's something where cotton is stuck with it. I can never understand how it's possible, but it's possible in an area where that's all the long release. And also, because at that time, the tundra was such a cold, such a large area, there wouldn't have been written in the very difficult to get out of the tundra. So what I suspect is that probably the cotton tree was just one thing about a single plant that was important. I would say cotton tree was the best thing that was important. That would be more than I would say cotton tree was the best thing that was important. The people were hunting at least at 10,000 years ago. Not evidence from other sites on northern Switzerland, but evidence that the bison killed the herbivore in Africa. And also the people, which is definitely now we have no idea that the people here at 10,000 years ago were sitting. It looks like that this was here. Certainly, the famine, I would say, was probably the cause of this. How long ago? question is how can one make it a determination? I'll get into that tomorrow, when I get into some statements tomorrow. And there are several different cases for students here tonight, but all of them depend on what you're doing. The question was, my mention of the groups were quite small, 10,000 people. Well, I don't know, actually. There was a lot of game around, and there was probably more games in the interior than the town. They didn't only have terrible people on that bike, or both for that. Probably have large herds. And if you have a lot of herd animals, then it may be that, for one thing, they want to have a lot of people together in the country. It's very effective to have a herd animal. So it may be together in the
country. If you say that you don't have a house site, you may not know what you want.
Only house site. The closest to it is the original one you have in the court, which is out of the house. And there we have such a large number of artifacts concentrated in one area. It's possible that there was some kind of path for house sites, but we found no trace of it. And there was no trace of the path of artifacts set up. So that, to me, is another one question here on it. I hope that this is another time when I'm talking to another artifact. Now, then, the final question is, were the Osmonds people the ancestors of that culture? And in the sense that my answer is, where I reckon Osmonds were, although it is evident that they stand up in a law court, but it is very possible that the Osmonds were 10,000 years ago.
But I mentioned that for some of the early artifacts that they were made in a style that found all the way across the northern hemisphere, and it's quite a characteristic technique of making implements, and one that once it was invented, it seems to have been such an obvious advantage over whatever people were doing before then, that everybody, as soon as they learned about it, then began to make tools in the same way. The idea is that in making stone tools, what you have to do is take some kind of large cobble, break it up in some way to get the kinds of flakes that you want in a certain shape, and then to chip those flakes into the final form. I've got two movies I'm going to be showing tomorrow on flint knapping. So you will see some people who in modern times have actually done flint knapping, and you get a good idea of how these tools are made. I would recommend that you try it, make sure you wear glasses, because if you're trying to chip flint or obsidian or bottle glass or something, or little flint will fly around, it's quite dangerous. That's probably one of the real occupational hazards in the early stone prehistoric time. But the idea is to get some kind of flake, and then so you can chip it to whatever form you want. For example, an arrowhead, a spearhead, or a knife blade, or something. Now, the early form of making tools, you just say to get a large cobble and smash it in some way. Just take another cobble, smash the thing, and you end up with a lot of different flakes of different shapes and all. But just running through the chips until you find a flake that you is about the right size you want. Take that out, and then by technique of either by hammering or pressure, and we will get to use the details tomorrow. But then say like just take another little hammer and just start hitting the flake and hitting it around the edge and until you've got the right kind of shape on it. Later on they use techniques where rather than hitting it, because you can see trying to get a flake knock off and of it. You can't hit exactly where you want it. It's quite difficult.
So what they do is take another kind of tool and just press on the edge and the flake will come off. And you can see that would be a great deal of control if you just simply press on the edge and have the flake come off. So, but you can see that with this kind of style where of flint knapping, it's quite wasteful because you end up with a lot of unusable types of flakes from there. So over time, what people develop is a technique, really I see it as the first mass production technique in stone working. They take a flake or a large cobble and they would shape the cobble to a certain kind of shape, knock off the top, and then maybe knock off the edges like this, all the rough outer surface that you can't use the flake. And then they would start striking from the top. This is called the platform. Start striking from the platform and knocking off flakes like this. And by carefully knocking off the flakes, they could end up with basically the same size flake time after time. And so you can see that for one thing, it saves a lot of material because you don't have any of these smaller odd shaped flakes that you have to throw away. But it also then gives the added advantage that you get flakes of about the same size and shape every time. So you can see the advantage of that is that if you can control the size and shape of flakes, you don't have to make so many different handles. So if you're making a knife, all you have to do is to make one knife handle, and then if you can just with one blade wears out, take it out, put in another one the same size and shape. So it was a very great advantage. It was a great discovery to make the flakes, be able to make the flakes off in the same size and shape. Now, this technique is called the blade and core technique. It's a term that was translated from French, but the idea is that you are able to make blades that is parallel-sided, something like knife blades off of here. The blades itself look like this. You can spot them, that it's a blade and not just simply a flake that's been chipped through these square shapes, because you can see a lot of old ridges left over on the surface. And that tells you it's come off of this kind of core, from this kind of technique. The core itself, then, you can also, it's easy to spot that it's from a bladed core technique because you have all of these old scars here, these parallel-sided scars. Now, this technique was first developed in the so-called Upper Paleolithic in Europe and in Asia, and about 30 or 40,000 years ago. But the technique then spread further and further to the east. It certainly wasn't just simply the spread of people across to the east, but the spread of the idea eastward, this manufactured blade core technique. Now, sometime around before 10,000 years ago, we don't know exactly when, this technique was further used, exactly the same technique, but further used to make very small tools. And at that time then, they would make, with the relative size, start making little blades this size. To distinguish between these two techniques, we use the word microblade, a microblade and core technology versus blade and core technology. The blade and core technology is certainly an outgrowth of this technology. It comes in later. But you can see here that you have a lot of other possible uses for microblades than you would for large blades like this. One of them is in an area where you have a great deal of antler around, it's quite easy and quite effective to make, say, arrowheads or spearheads out of antler. You can carve just the right shape, say an antler spearhead, nice long spearhead, cylindrical, but let's give it a kind of a pointed shape to put in the shaft. With your wooden shaft, cottonwood. Wooden shaft with the antler arrowhead or spearhead. We don't know when the arrow, bow and arrow was invented, but the spear. So an antler point is quite good. But now, if you want to make it more effective, let's put a good sharp cutting edge on it. And what they did then was carve slots into this. I'll take this from the other side. And just cut in a slot like this, and then just take these little microblades and just shove them in. So on the side, what you do is you shove them in like this. And put them all along here, maybe on both sides. And you can see this is quite a wicked weapon. And even if you didn't want to use them only for spears or something like this, they make nice knives. So put instead of a long shaft, make a little handle out of like this. And what you've got is an antler with a nice cutting edge along here. And this is especially effective in an area where, say, you're having trouble getting a lot of wood. You don't need that much wood, you can use antler, especially if antler is around all over. So this technique of microblade manufacture then became especially important up in the Arctic. Now what I'll do is pass around just a couple of examples here. This is an example of a microblade that's made out of obsidian, volcanic glass. This one was found on the Noatak River. I'll pass this around just to make that a minute. To get an idea of what these are like. The microblade itself then is made from a type of core, slightly different shape. Rather than making the blades off of a flat surface, they wanted quite narrow microblades. So what they did was make a core and chip the flakes off of the narrow end. So say this is the end, they knock off the microblade, or, and that's looking like this, or sideways then, the microblade coming off here, with a platform on this. And these types of microblade cores, this is one that's particularly called a wedge-shaped microblade core, because if you look at the opposite end over here, it then flakes to an edge here, cross section, and it looks sort of like this. And that's what gives it its term, the name wedge shape, because it looks like a wedge shape. But this is a microblade core. Around here, these date to the back as early as 10,000 years ago. We found these cores in Akman, and we have also found this kind of core in other early sites. In this region, already by something like 5,000 years ago, these cores are no longer made in this area. That's, I think, I'll pass this one around here. Look at the flat surface, and what you'll see is a lot of these parallel lines on it. So this is where the microblades came off of. The microblade that's being passed around now was taken off of a core that was a bit larger than this one, as you can see, but still basically the same shape. So the blade or the microblade and core technique or the blade and core technique are techniques that are associated with early man in the Arctic. And it's something that stylistically connects up the American Arctic with all of the Asian and Northern European areas. If one traces the whole distribution of the microblade manufacture all over the world, it's found Europe, Northern Europe, Northern Asia, Northern North America, and even around the Mediterranean. It's uncanny. You can even find them in the desert, the Sahara Desert. I think over there it was used for the same technique, although they were farming over there and they were used in something like a pickle where these microblades were set in some of carved bone like this. But still the same manufacturing technique for the microblades. All these others, well, they date around the same time, 10, 12,000 years ago, maybe even back to 14,000 years ago. Whereas the large blade and core technique goes back to 20,000, maybe even a bit earlier. So you can see that this area, in some ways, one might think is isolated at times, at least in the past, but it really hasn't been. There's been constant communication almost worldwide that this region has been a part of for at least 10,000 years, probably longer. Have you all had a chance to look at the microblade? Can you see on a core the spaces here? It's interesting, I did an archaeological survey for the Selowik farm site last summer, and on one of the hills right near the farm found a core exactly like that. And this was the first core that from that age then has been found in the Selowik too. So now they've been found in the Selowik area, the Kobuk and the Noatak, and then up on the north coast too. It's quite exciting. Well, no, you didn't. One reason why I'm bringing in the film for tomorrow is that I can't show you myself. I've tried to do these, and it comes out terrible. My ability is about at the level of the lower Paleolithic. I haven't even evolved to middle Paleolithic yet. What they do on these is, once they set up the core, and they've got a platform here, then they take something like what can be called a punch, and just say, for example, if this were the core here, and then just press hard on top here, and the whole plate will come off all the way down to the bottom. And there's something about the structure of the stone that once you have some ridges set up, the next time you break another one off behind it, it tends to follow the same ridges. And so this was a discovery back in the Paleolithic then. Somebody said that as soon as you set up some ridges, then you've got half the battle won already. Because then all you have to do is press just the right pressure at the time, it'll come off and practically duplicate what was there before. Each one come off.
Right, it has to be a certain kind of...
Yes, right. The obsidian, well, first it has to be some kind of rock that is homogeneous, that it has the same material, the same structure all the way through it. And it can't be a rock that, say, breaks naturally in planes, because if you've got a lot of rocks, will break in a plane. If it's got a plane in it, you press, doesn't matter which way you press, it's always going to break along that plane. So you need a rock that is homogeneous. Obsidian is really the best there is on that. And it's just like glass too. And again, I warn you, don't try it, but you can take bottle glass, say the bottom of a whiskey bottle, and you can flake that and make tools out of it. I know people who can make nice, beautiful arrowheads out of bottle glass. But it takes a technique. They even have flint mapping tools nowadays. In Idaho, there's one, quite a well-known one. And you work something like, what is it, about 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for 9 weeks. And you come out and you can start making these kinds of stuff. But they say, one of my students went there last summer, and he said that everybody for the first week just had a bloody hand, and they just with all of the cuts, and they have to wear goggles, but even then there's cuts all over their face outside of the goggles. Quite dangerous. But it's primarily through the pressure plating that you get these little flakes on. Other kinds of material that is good for flaking is chert or flint, and especially the chert is Akmak type that was used at Akmak site. It's almost the same as the city, it's just that it's gray, it's not glassy, it's almost the same. And then you have great control, because whichever way you strike the rock, you can be sure that the flake is going to go off in that direction.